You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Unwinding a Commercial Real Estate Transaction Part 2. I'm pleased to introduce our speakers. Joining us from Philadelphia is Richard Goldberg. Mr. Goldberg is a retired partner of Ballard's Bar, LLP. Mr. Goldberg has more than 40 years' experience in real estate and law practice and with a major national developer. He is past president of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers and past chair of the Anglo-American Real Property Institute. He is also a fellow of the American College of Mortgage Attorneys. Mr. Goldberg will serve as the leader of today's program. Joining us from Chicago is Anthony Licata. Mr. Licata is a partner with Taft, Stettinius, and Hollister LLP, where he has formerly chaired the firm's real estate practice. He has an extensive practice focusing on major commercial real estate transactions, including finance, development, leasing, and land use. He formerly served as an adjunct professor at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University and at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Also joining us from Chicago is Mark Belongnia, a partner with Johnson & Bell LTD, where his practice focuses on advising and defending banks and thrift organizations in regulatory and transactional matters. He works with the banks of all sizes, from community and regional financial institutions to money center banks. He regularly represents clients before U.S. Department of the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, FDIC, and SEC. He has extensive experience in the workout of troubled real estate projects. Mr. Goldberg, I hand the program over to you.
Well, thank you very much and welcome, everybody. This is the second of two programs on real estate restructuring and unwinding the commercial transaction. We're going to discuss drafting of forbearance and loan modifications. We're going to discuss drafting and structuring other kinds of documents. We'll be talking extensively about what are the alternatives to doing a workout, including certain kinds of restructures. We'll go into a little more depths about receivership. And finally, we're going to talk a little bit about what we call loan-to-own strategies. Let's get started. And Mark, do you want to talk a little bit about forbearance agreements?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Dick. So most people are familiar with the term forbearance agreement and understand that it is the lender agreeing to forbear from exercising its rights. These are often used when I find the most common is when there's a maturity default. In other words, the loan came due, had to be paid off. Commercial loans are usually 1, 3, 5, 7, 10 years. And at the due date, the money wasn't paid. And so for whatever reason, the borrower now stands in a default, not having paid off the loan. So the lender, in communication with the borrower, and usually they're in good terms, such that the borrower has a recapitalization and or ability to refinance and take out the lender, and as so, they just need more time. And they need more time to accomplish it, and the lender is willing to give it for a price, is willing to forbear and allow the borrower more time to refinance. And so I just want to walk through some of the key terms that are in a forbearance agreement, why they're there, you know, what's the benefit to the lender or the borrower or both. So one of the important aspects in the beginning of any forbearance agreement is an agreement on the outstanding loan amount. You'd be surprised how often there is a disagreement between the borrower and the lender on what the actual principal amount is due. A misapplication of payments, the borrower thinks it made more payments than it actually did. There's many times a dispute about that bottom line number, and this is, in a forbearance agreement, the place where you come to an agreement, what is the amount due and owing as of the date of maturity or the date of the forbearance agreement, whatever you choose, and it eliminates that dispute from arising in the future. The forbearance agreement, in my opinion, is an excellent tool to, especially in, let's say, a 10-year note situation, lots of things happen over 10 years, to be able to address any disputed items, ambiguities, things that have occurred, and tighten up the relationship to essentially bring it back to zero and move forward, knowing that there are no things that are going to haunt, for example, the lender down the road if the forbearance agreement is itself defaulted. Another important aspect is defaults. There, again, oftentimes is a dispute between borrower and lender on, you know, what covenants were blown and such. What are the events of default? Is it a payment default? It is some activity default, a million different things based on the covenants and the loan documents. And so this is, again, a place where lender and borrower can agree, because different events of defaults have different consequences. So, you know, for example, some events of default will trigger personal guarantee obligations, some won't. So it's really important between borrower and lender that you come to an agreement on what exactly, besides, let's say, a maturity default, have occurred so that it's documented for future use. Another important aspect is the loan agreements, the loan documents themselves. The parties agree that the documents are legal, valid, binding, and enforceable against borrower and guarantor in accordance with the terms. Why is that important? Again, from the lender perspective, that the borrower can't later in time somehow argue that there was some deficiency in the origination of the loan and the subsequent loan documentation, and therefore that they don't have the obligation the bank attests to. So that's, again, another important aspect from the lender's perspective. The next, the default notice was properly given. So, again, the borrower can't claim that the form of notice was deficient, wasn't served, that there's no waiver of defaults by the lender. That he's now, by entering into the document, the forbearance agreement, the lender isn't waiving any of the defaults and waiving any of its rights to proceed on any rights and remedies. Also, again, these are all the common components, provisions of a forbearance agreement, but from the lender perspective, how important they are is to, again, eliminate any future disputes and have the borrower and guarantor or guarantors all agree on certain conduct.
Mark, it's Tony. Would you say that one of the key features from the borrower's side of the forbearance is that once you sign that, your ability to contest the foreclosure in the future, if it got to that, is pretty severely curtailed?
Correct.
And that's why the lender Correct. Sometimes is willing to give you that for at least 90 days or something, because in a lot of respects they may be cutting off a lot of defensive time later on, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, what we saw in the Great Recession was a substantial amount of lender errors in its documentation. And that opened the door for lots of borrowers to tie up litigation in the courts for years, because the documentation, for example, a lot of mid-sized and smaller banks use what's called LaserPro. LaserPro are documents that are generated, you know, basically by a laser printer, and they're standard and they're state-specific, but they're not modifiable. And as a result, you don't have lawyers a lot of times preparing the documentation, even on larger loans, you'd be stunned. Instead, you have bank personnel, clerks, essentially, in the documentation department cranking out these documents. And they fail to record, UCCs. I mean, there was just a million errors. And the best way that the bank was able to deal with these was by the use of a forbearance agreement, because it cleaned everything up and it eliminated all those. But in exchange, you know, the borrower did get more time. So, you know, both sides benefited and benefit from a forbearance agreement. Now, an important other point from the lender perspective is the ability to get a forbearance fee. You know, time costs money, and forbearances usually don't come for free. They come for a fee, not free, and can be rather substantial depending on the circumstances. And for the bank, that, you know, these are a cash cow, because they are direct to the bottom line to profit, because they're not related to any other expense. So they're a nice moneymaker for the financial institution, and the borrower really, most of the time, doesn't have any alternative to negotiate the fee. It's pretty one-sided, and if you want a forbearance, you're going to pay the fee. It lays out, you know, the payments that are due during the forbearance period, and importantly, because the loan has been defaulted, it also says how the payments are going to be applied. That's often a negotiated point is, you know, the bank wants it to go all to interest, the borrower wants it to go all to principal, so it's a negotiated provision on how the payments are going to be applied, because ultimately that affects the principal amount due at the end of the forbearance agreement. So that's an important part of the negotiation.
I think the biggest impact to me has always been the admission of the debt. I mean,
correct.
The fact that you now have admitted that the debt exists, you've quantified the amount of the debt, and so therefore, as we said, you said before, there goes your foreclosure. Your defense to a foreclosure, you don't know. There's not much for you to be able to say at that point in time about well, look what they did to me. And the other thing is, there's usually a waiver of lender liability.
Correct.
And I correct in those forbearance agreements, which one could claim duress over, but in fact, it's not really duress. It's really help.
Right. You know, also another provision that's important is the addition of any additional reserves. For example, if one of the issues that occurred during the previous loan period is the failure to pay property taxes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you're going to have a 12-month forbearance. Well, you want to ensure that during that 12 months that, you know, there's the money available to pay the property taxes such that you're not going to go right back into an event of default because they failed to pay the taxes in 3 months. So, you know, that's another provision that you put on the borrower to ensure that, you know, in exchange for more time, that you get compliance with what's necessary on the loan. You know, here's an important one. Tony, do you want to jump in on that one?
I just wanted to ask you a question. From a bank regulatory point of view, Mark, is a loan that you have a forbearance on technically a non-performing loan, and therefore they have to reserve it on their reserves?
Correct.
So that's a detriment to the bank, right? They've got a
correct
an impairment, and so that's one of the reasons why they want a fee and so forth, right?
Correct. And also, though, the forbearance agreement is a great piece of paper to put in front of the regulators at exam time to say that, you know, you had this problem loan. It was on, you know, the trouble list, the watch list. Every bank calls it something different. And you've been assertive in resolving, you believe, that troubled credit, and here's how we solved it, versus in an examination saying, look, this matured, has been paid off, what's the plan? And the worst answer is to say, we don't know, we haven't been able to get a hold of the borrower.
Right.
Examiner goes, you know, bananas. Whereas instead, it's right on top of the file when they walk in and do their examination and say, look, we were assertive, we were proactive, we had a borrower, we have a maturity default, but we've resolved it, and we expect the bank to be paid off on X day. They're much happier seeing that.
The regulator answer is you can find them when you serve them, I take it.
Right.
Okay.
Another key provision is the authorization that the execution, delivery, and performance of the agreement and the prior loan documents are all duly authorized by the necessary corporate partnership, whatever. I've seen that, too, where in litigation, for the first time ever, a borrower or guarantor argues that the person who executed did it without their knowledge or company authorization. I litigated one of those cases for 3 years where it was six members of an LLC. There were five different banks involved, and my bank was claimed, entered into the transaction with the entity by way of a signature of a member who did not have the authority. It was a mess. Forbearance cleans that up, prevents that from happening. The enforceability provision, Dick, you kind of mentioned this before, but basically that, you know, the borrower and guarantors agree that all the terms of the loan documents and this agreement are enforceable as against them. Again, this just buttons everything down and shuts down any defenses should this vehicle be defaulted and you end up in court.
I mean, in essence, it's like you have signed new loan documents.
It's essentially correct that you're not only signing new loan documents, but you're actually signing agreements of conduct that you're affirming.
Right.
You know, and so it's a step above even the loan documents.
Yeah, which is why the banks, I think, forget the fee. I mean, I think the fee is a fee, but I think that's why most banks are willing to do them, because they understand the fact that once you have a forbearance agreement, the next time
game over.
Yeah, game over. The next time you fail, the borrower fails to perform, it is over. And again, it's a. I haven't seen many. Have you guys seen many forbearance agreements done in CMBS lending?
Not really.
I've seen one where that's what the special servicer recommended, because it was a temporary. Particularly when it's a temporary glitch, you know, when you have a major space vacant and you have a plan, they might sign a forbearance. They might recommend the signing of a forbearance agreement, but it still needs the whole process. You still have to go through the whole process.
Yeah.
And going through the whole process discourages the special servicer from asking anything.
Yeah.
Yep. And then another provision that is very useful is the no litigation provision, which basically says that the borrower and guarantors have no knowledge of any current or threatened litigation. I've used this provision several times to flush out potential litigation or claims of members against other members in an LLC.
Yeah.
Because the one will come forward and say, well, I can't sign it as it is because actually I think, you know, Bob, my partner, stole money. That's why we defaulted. So I've been able to flush out things which we've been able to rectify by having this provision, that without this provision, we would have entered in the transaction not knowing that Bob was about to sue Ted, or vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then just lastly, you know, you also get to define the events of default of the forbearance, which may or may not be the same as the underlying loan documents. So, you know, in sum, it's a very useful tool to resolve a defaulted borrower situation, to get controls over the situation and have a concrete path forward, and it's clear to all parties what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, instead of we are, I think, now ready to talk about the other forms of documentation that occurs in restructuring. You know, negotiating, structuring, the failed real estate documentation other than forbearance or modifications. Tony, do you want to take that?
Mark, that was a great exposition of the forbearance agreement, which is really a document between the borrower and the lender. I want to focus in for a few minutes on documentation that occurs over on the borrower side. Typically, if you're going to be in any kind of a distress or workout situation, in my experience, it will almost always lead to a reshuffling of the deck of cards that comprises the ownership entity that is the borrower. And there are a number of different provisions that will come up. You'll typically be structuring this as an amendment. Sometimes you'll do it as an amended and restated LLC operating agreement. Just as a matter of personal practice, I always prefer the amended and restated LLC agreement, as in just about all my contracts. I like to amend and restate in their entirety, because I don't know about you guys, but I don't like having a contract that's got eight different amendments, and then you're trying to read through all the amendments and figure out which one trumps which one, et cetera. You're better off to amend and restate the whole thing from scratch every time, in my personal experience. So what is the single driving factor in that whole process tends to be that the enterprise needs money. And so that money is going to come in one of two ways. Either the existing partners are going to be putting up more money, or the you might be reaching out and bringing in a new partner. In either event, the provisions of the agreement that specify who put in what has to be changed, because those numbers are going to be changing. And more importantly, that will always virtually lead to a number of other changes in the operating agreement. And let me give you a few of those. The first and the most significant one, I believe, is that the event of someone putting in more money, whether it's an existing investor or a new investor coming in, will almost certainly bring about a adjustment or renegotiation of how, if there ever ends up being any proceeds of sale or cash flow from the property, how are the benefits to be distributed to those people who have put money up, and usually there's somebody in the deal who's the manager or the promoter of the deal, and how does that? So we often call those provisions the waterfall, because typically those provisions provide for a cascade of money. You have so-called tranches, layers in which the capital gets or the funds that are to be distributed get paid out. Typically, that payout will look like first to the people who put the money up in the proportions that they put it up. Then they may get more money out for a preferred return, and then there may be a distribution to the manager. Those the inventiveness of managers and promoters in coming up with structures for that almost knows no bounds, and we've probably all seen many, many variations of that. But the key is whatever the old deal was pretty much goes out the window, and it's going to get renegotiated again, whether the capital is coming from your existing investors or whether it's coming from a new investor. Now, a lot of times when you put the deal together in the first go-round, the first iteration of that deal, there will be provisions in there that say if the deal needs more money and we'll issue a capital call and everybody puts up their share, then nothing changes. But if individuals don't participate, there's mechanisms for raising the portion that was not contributed in response to the call. And those provisions typically call for some sort of penalty to those who did not contribute. Well, the problem is in a seriously distressed real estate deal, if you're in the middle of a market crash, for example, and people are concerned that the value is plunged to the point, value of the property is plunged to the point where you're no longer even covering the mortgage debt, there is no equity in the property. People become reluctant at that point to put more capital in. They see it as throwing good money after bad. And so even if you have those capital call provisions, it won't matter because no one will put capital in response to that. At least under the prior structure, and that will lead to a renegotiation, as I said. So the first thing that will happen is all of those waterfall capital distribution provisions will get changed. Another common change that you'll see in the renegotiation or a negotiation of a new structure is typically the right of the investor class to approve various transactions or major transactions or decision-making. Not unusual, in the first iteration of the deal, the investors put their money in and they're fairly passive. Sometimes they'll have approval rights over so-called major decisions, but sometimes they won't, and sometimes if they do have major decisions, it'll be a relatively small list. I can pretty well guarantee you that if you're in a workout and you're having to put more money in, there'll be a lot of discussion about increasing to the extent they weren't already provided, increasing the investor vote or say-so over decision-making beyond just major decision-making. They may extend to more day-to-day operational matters. So the change in the decision-making structure is a second major category, if you will, of a restructuring document. The third category that we see, unfortunately, in a lot of these situations is investor class has completely lost confidence in their developer, their promoter, their manager, and they want a change. Those are often, Mark and Dick, in my experience, mm-hmm. the toughest ones, because now you're trying to exit the person who put the deal together, who knows has been running the property, But sometimes the investors are, if they have sufficient power and money and resources, and they're sufficiently unhappy with the existing management, they may insist that we change pitchers. We want a pitcher who can get somebody out. And we got somebody who can't get anybody. All he's doing is keep putting people on base. We've got to have a better pitcher. And so when that happens, that's really a challenge, because now you got to get the former manager or promoter out. And I have seen, it's not unusual, I've seen the promoters and developers in that situation say, listen, if you really want me out of here, cut me a check as part of your capital contribution, pay me some money, and I'll go, and you can pick whoever you want to try to run the property. I tend to find that this situation occurs more in the case of a operating asset such as a hotel or a shopping center or something like that, where the hands-on day-to-day management really has more of an impact. If you have a property that's a single tenant, you know, net leased property or something like that, you know, it's not as big a situation. It's harder to blame the manager. If you have a Walgreens deal and the Walgreens lease expired and they don't renew, it's hard to blame the manager for that. Walgreens didn't want to be there anymore, you know. So it depends on circumstances. But I would say, Dick and Mark, those are the three first big aspects of the renegotiation. The second category, aside from extra, that all fits under the extra capital and what's going to happen if you need extra capital. Those same issues will come up in the second major category, I believe, which is credit enhancement. Sometimes your way out of the workout is to get one of the investors to say, listen, I'll give a partial guarantee, or I'll give a total guarantee or something. And I can assure you that if that is going to be the format of the transaction, that everything we just said about changing the waterfall, changing the decision-making structure, and maybe even changing the manager, all of that is going to get renegotiated and changed significantly if we start fooling around with guarantee exposure. So that's my take on navigating the borrower issues associated with a workout.
You know, important point, that it really depends on who your partner is as to what's likely to happen. If you're dealing with a fund, I would suggest to you that it's highly unlikely that you're going to want, the fund is going to want to really, they're not geared up to take over management. They're not, that's not what they do for a living. They would bring in another, you know, and when we talk about managers, they're really, let's face it, we are talking about two kinds of managers. We're talking about who actually physically runs the real estate and the deal, but the other thing that we're also talking about is who is the managing partner, you know, under the transaction, who, you know, and we're all losing the promote, and as Tony aptly pointed out, you know they lose interest, and that's never a good thing. It never happens. It's never a good thing for them to lose interest. When things get to that level, and we pointed this out yesterday, you really need to know who your partner is. It's very, very difficult sometimes when you're representing a developer and you're their counsel, to get the developer to kind of understand their options. Even if they're large developers, the notion that they can or will lose their investment, lose their property, as I said yesterday, it's like losing a child. When you represent them, I think you really do have to be very, very careful as to how you manage the relationship with your client and their options. Because they will tell you, you know, if you being blunt doesn't necessarily work. It not only will not accomplish a restructure, it will also mean that you'll never see them again.
Right, exactly.
And well, that is not necessarily a binding consideration. I would suggest to you it is not an unimportant consideration in terms of how you deal with your clients. So bear that in mind.
Yeah, Dick, I agree with you. I mean, one of the major obstacles that lenders often face with developers is what you just said. If a developer is taking this project as their personal baby and can't let go and can't let go of control, and it's to their detriment, but they can't see it, and they're not willing to listen to it, and it's the biggest hurdle that we have to overcome on the other side of the table is to get them to understand that it's not theirs anymore. You know, it's everybody's, and we got to figure it out collectively, and they don't call the shots anymore, which, you know, given the type of personality of most developers, that's an incredibly difficult task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that is correct. And it's kind of an imperative that you understand that. And I will tell you that that's one of the reasons why, you know, I always like my clients to end up dealing with their relationship loans as opposed to their, you know, to the CMBS loan. Because with a relationship lender, there is empathy and sympathy. The longer you've been dealing, the longer you've had the relationship, you're going to want to get paid back. But they're more likely to listen, especially in the event that there's a capacity you think that they're going to survive and they're going to get future business. The CMBS loan, it's absolutely no consideration of that. And I'm not hostile to CMBS loans. They play an incredibly important part in our industry. But I will also say to you that they are not for the unwary, and they're not really. I mean, if I have a very small company that I'm representing, I would suggest that this is not necessarily the best environment for them to enter into. Even though they look at me as if I'm crazy, because of the notion of how you end up trying to do a workout with someone you don't know.
And I can attest to that, Dick. I represented two lawyer/real estate developers in a workout with a CNBC special servicer, and CNBS, it was incredibly difficult, and the end result was, I think, bad for everybody, and it was from the lack of any relationship, any interest in discussion, you know, a disconnected servicer to two small guys that were mismatched. It was just, they should never have taken that loan for that very reason. You're 100% right.
Yeah. It's difficult. Even when I worked for my large publicly traded company, which of course, as I mentioned before, never liked to sell anything. Finally discovered that these were not children. These were just assets of our shareholders, but the most difficult thing I had to do in doing the CMB, the early CMBS loans, was in fact dealing with the mentality of how do you deal with a CMBS lender, and so it really is not easy. It's really difficult. I think let's talk about what are the restructuring alternatives to a workout? Mark, do you want to get into that a little bit?
Sure. We kind of talked a little bit about it yesterday, but I'll kind of go over again, kind of the other options that are available. One is, a loan modification, which is different than a forbearance agreement. We talked at the beginning today about a forbearance agreement and what that accomplishes. A loan modification is essentially entering into a new credit agreement with the bank. And there's various reasons why it makes sense. And they're not even related to, for example, defaults or problems, but, it can be. So they're very useful tools. Modifying commercial real estate loans, happens when there's a change of control in the borrower, a change in ownership. There is a new lender after assignment of the loan from the existing lender. That happens when the loan is sold off and they want to redock the loan, essentially. that, let's say there's a consensual long-term restructuring of the loan workout, and the loan matures and there's other events of default and you want to add, release, or substitute collateral, which gets sort of beyond the basics of what the forbearance agreement does, and you start really monkeying with all of the terms, you're better off moving into the loan modification space. A lot of times, too, you look at the borrower and things that have occurred during the life of the loan, and you want to change or add more borrower covenants. Things that, you know, weren't initially anticipated have now occurred, which had a direct effect on the loan, and you want to prevent that from occurring again, so you can, again, add or change that provision. Change the legal description of the real property because maybe there's been a subdivision of the property since the initial loan was done. Add or release guarantors. You know, there again, situations may change. Tony mentioned it before, credit enhancement. So, you know, we've added guarantors, which change up the mechanisms by which there's a relationship between the borrower and guarantors, and so you can modify the loan to reflect that.
You know, let's also chat a little bit about bringing in new entities, new partners, new entities.
Sure. So oftentimes, especially with commercial real estate, over time, you know, people come in and out of deals. Sometimes people need liquidity, so they, you know, swap positions in different properties. So as a result, you want to modify the loan to consistently always be properly reflecting who's the borrower and who are the guarantors. Because, again, in the Great Recession and all the litigation that was going on, I can tell you there were multiple times where there was a change in the borrower status or guarantor status that directly affected the obligation or the ability to repay. And what happened is that wasn't properly reflected in the loan documents. I had two circumstances where when we went to go file suit against the borrowers, the borrowers were defunct. There was a new entity which title had been conveyed to, and the bank had no idea that that even occurred, and it caused a whole slew of problems and years in litigation to unravel, where a simple paying attention to your borrower and modifying the loan to reflect what occurred would have solved all of that. There's a prime example of, you know, everyone being in communication and the bank monitoring, obviously, their relationship with their borrower to know what's going on. And it can be also a correction of collateral issues. I just want to mention that, too. I had a situation years ago where the original loan was rolling stock. It wasn't real estate, but it was rolling stock, which were trucks. And all of the VIN numbers were from the wrong group of trucks. It came to the bank's attention. The bank forgot about it. I don't know how you do that, but they did. And when they went to foreclose on the rolling collateral, there was none. That was a total disaster. Let's just say there ended up being claims of legal malpractice, and it spun off a lot of litigation, which wasn't necessarily good for anybody. But there's a prime example of post-transaction modifying the loan documents to properly reflect the collateral.
The entire 2008 collapse is an example of what happened. You know, lost notes from people. You know, robo signings. Just, you know, I was maybe fortunately or unfortunately the real property advisor to the redrafting of Article 8 of Article 9 rather, and consistently opposed the ability to have an Article 9 financing, you know, do an Article 9 security of mortgage notes. And guess what? I think I was right. I think that really was one of the real major problems of, you know, of what happened in the collapse. But, you know, remember your bank clients are fine and you love them, but they are not the most perfect institution in the world, you know, to cope with. So I think you really do have to, notice this.
Right.
You know, let's talk about what, you know, one of the things that I think is very, very important when you do, which, by the way, when you do your deal, which is very, very hard to cope with in a CMBS loan, and that is your ability to restructure what the loan documents suggest to you is your ability to restructure. And so therefore, now you find that you have the ability, or you negotiate and buy the ability to do that from your lending institution. Let's talk about bringing in what you need to do to bring in somebody new, and how does that really work. Do you want to pick that up, Mark or Tony?
Yeah, Mark, I could mention something that during
sure.
the crash, people might want to keep in mind. It was a little bit unorthodox, maybe, but during the crash, 2008, 2009. A lot of the banks were in worse shape than the borrowers. They were all teetering on the brink of going under. They had already been forced to take down major write-downs on a number of these loans, and so we had some good success with actually bringing in a outside group and offering to buy the note from the bank
right.
at a discount.
Yep. Yep.
And believe it or not, you know, the banks were, we found in a number of instances, the banks were far more receptive to that than one might have thought. And they particularly got receptive every time we were near the end of a quarter or near the end of a fiscal year, because they really were under pressure from the regulators to get certain of these assets lifted or off their books, as the case may be. And so as a result of that, we had lots of instances where we were able to get the loan. So we in effect worked our way out of the loan by bringing in a new investor group who bought the note at a discount and then made some kind of a deal with the old investor group, maybe a new joint venture, maybe a new overall partnership
yep,
or something.
Yep.
And
I did a ton of those. Yeah, I did
yeah,
a ton of those. In fact, I actually, you know, there was a group that actually here in Chicago, a client of mine who auctioned off the notes and in
yep.
huge portfolios, just like that. And I also had some bank clients who entered into AB notes with borrowers.
Yep.
In other words,
mm-hmm.
they modified to say, all right, you owe us $1 million. We know you're never going to see it. We'll do an A note at 250, interest only for 2 years. The B note will be a balloon due in 5 years. The loan's already been charged off. So if we get anything, great. And then they went off and sold note A for 50 cents on the dollar.
Right, just to get some cash in.
Yeah, just to get the cash in, because it's already charged off on the bank's books.
Right.
So it's a zero value already. And being able to recoup those dollars goes directly to their capital ratios. And
right.
so a lot of the banks that were struggling were hovering around the 2% capital level, and at under 2%, they become severely undercapitalized, which triggers bad things. Namely, the you know in Illinois, for example, the notice of the right to take possession and control of the institution and place the FDIC as receiver in 60 or 90 days. And once you go there, you can't get out of there. Even if you
yeah.
do bump over 2%, they're not going to even look at it. They're going to just do whatever they need to do to keep you below 2% and you're toast.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
sure. So that's an example. And then, Dick, you also have the category, might be running out of a little time here to get to this last category, the loan-to-own folks. Mark, you've got some experience with those, too. Generally, there's a category of lenders out there, in my experience at least, who never really were in the business of lending to get repaid with their interest. They were lending candidly in the hope that the borrower would get into trouble because they wanted to grab the real estate at
yep,
70%
yep.
or 75% of what its then value was. Mark, my experience is
yes.
if you find yourself dealing with a lender like that, they are going to want the keys, period. And the best thing you can hope for there is to have them give up tear up the guarantee. Maybe you can get them to let you keep some of the rental income for a while. They'll hold off their taking title for a few months while you can pull some rental income out. In a few cases, I've actually even seen the lenders cut a check to the defaulted borrower to go away.
It's essentially an illegal scheme. It doesn't
yeah.
mean it doesn't happen, but it has. I'll give
yeah.
you a prime example. And I'll use the bank and their bank's name because they're out of business. But Broadway Bank in Chicago was a prime example. It was a bank that targeted one certain ethnic minority, which was similar to the ownership, and that ethnic minority is in primarily the restaurant business. And so as a result, they would loan whatever and more of what was asked, knowing the fact that they didn't care because there would be a default very quickly, and they wanted the land. Okay, that's what they were after. And what they would do is after they made the loan, they'd sell the loan off to an entity wholly owned by owners of the bank, who then would proceed to foreclose once the loan was defaulted, and they were charging like 35% default interest. So even if they could somehow come up with the money, they could never come up with enough because the default interest was so incredible, and the fees and expenses and everything. And then, because the whole goal in that situation was to end up owning the real estate, which they in turn would then lease back to the borrower to run the restaurant.
Yeah, we have about 8 or 9 minutes left. Let's talk about the a lot of the alternatives aside from loan to own. I happened to at one point in time represent a loan to own investor, and by the way, they did it through through the LLC agreement.
Right.
And rather than it was not a loan, they became a non managing member, but it really didn't take very much for them to become a managing member. Because you're drafting your events of the events pursuant to which they can take over. And you make them very, very strict, not only with respect to payment to them, but with respect to loan defaults, with respect to failure to follow certain processes, like getting approval, having total budget approval.
These are all the so-called change in control provisions.
Right. And thus, once for example, if you have total control provision. And you can't arrive at a budget, total budget approval provision, and you can't arrive at a budget, provided you are again acting in good faith, which is a defense, although really may not be a defense, because the real question is, acting in the obligation to act in good faith is really a uniform commercial code invention. And while you're dealing with an entity, you do have an obligation to deal in good faith. When things are going bad, it is very, very easy to take a position. I'm acting in good faith, and I don't like what you're doing. It's not hard when you have a very expensive project, even an inexpensive project, that is not performing anywhere close to the expectations that they perform. And if it does perform and close to the expectations, the loan-to-own lender has also negotiated a deal by which they're making a lot of money. They don't necessarily have to own it, but if they're not making the kind of return that they want, which is usually a higher return than you will find by getting yourself a conventional partner, more conventional partner, they then start to exert remedies. And the next thing you're at the developer, have lost your child. You've got to be very, very, very careful, and you have to understand the basis and the reputation of the people with whom you deal. One thing that a loan-to-own entity will be more likely to do will be to either loan or invest more money than you can get from anybody else. Otherwise, why would you do it?
Right.
And I've discovered over the course of almost 50 years, that given the choice of can I get less money from somebody nice or more money from somebody mean, inevitably my clients get blinded by the dollar signs.
Every time.
Every time. Yeah.
They all think it's going to go better than they hope, and that they're going to be able to pay the money back and get out of it. And we've all seen the... we've all seen the casualties of that kind of thinking, haven't we?
Yeah.
Sure have.
And again, when You know, the loan-to-own investor is usually very well insulated from market collapse. Matter of fact, that's what they're hoping for, because they end up they can end up owning assets at a very, very significantly low, you know, for them low, you know, low investment, and because the return will be so much greater once they take it over, even if it's underwater. They have the time and patience and money to wait for the turnaround. You know, for example, if you were messing around in 2008 through 2011, you were in terrible, desperate shape. But if you managed to survive, look where you are now.
Yeah.
You know, they were two of the long, you know, I think 2007 and 2008 was a depression, at least for the real estate market. You can call it whatever you want to call it. It was really tough. But boy, has there been a, you know, an enormous increasing run up, and and they are.
Dick, I would say this about that. The Mark, let's get your take. I will say that the banks seem to have had more discipline ever since the 2008-2009 debacles. I find them to be tougher on their underwriting. Now, there's still plenty of people out there running around dangling money, you know, particularly the hedge fund people. So be careful with some of those private lender, shadow banking, hedge fund groups, because they're clearly, you know,
predatory.
predatory.
They're predatory.
Predatory. But I would say, Mark, that the banking system, to me at least, seems to be better off than it was in. Things were doing silly stuff in 2006, 2007. It's how you knew you were approaching a top, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think to comment on that, one of the things that's also happened is, you know, the winnowing down of the amount of banks out there. You know, a lot of it's interesting because a lot of the community banks that failed, they were de novo banks that were started by people that had made a significant amount of money in real estate, commercial real estate. And because of that, they thought because they were knowledgeable about commercial real estate and they were knowledgeable about borrowing money, that they were knowledgeable about banking.
Right.
And there's at least seven examples in this market alone of that. You know, when the crash happened, there was no liquidity in the ownership, which means they had no money to infuse in capital into the bank to prevent the failure.
As a result, all those banks
are gone. So you have a stronger banking system with significantly better bankers, in my opinion, in today's market than you did 15 years ago.
And you also have some statutory controls that you didn't have years ago.
Correct.
about the risk, the ability to take on risk. And I think that's made a very, very substantial difference. I think bank underwriting is as difficult as I can remember over the course of, you know, the course of the years that I've been practicing.
There's an old saying that just because you know how to eat doesn't mean you know how to run a restaurant, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, having worked for the company that in Harbor Place had its major restaurant when it opened failed and we took over the restaurant, the answer is I understand that. Although we were voted the best Italian restaurant in Baltimore in the year that we opened, so I have no idea how that happened. I think we're out of time, and it's time to open the program to questions. Who are our listeners? Could you, operator, please provide our listeners with instructions as to how they can ask their questions?
Yes, sir. If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touchtone phone, followed by the one key. That's star one. When you do, you will be told your place in line. To get out of the queue, just press the pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Let me ask you a question while we're waiting for our listeners. I assume you're seeing less workouts than you've seen before, but how much of the alternative purchasers have you seen in the marketplace today, and how many borrowers have really
used it? Not a lot.
Yeah.
You know, the workouts have really dried up because of, A, they were worked out. B, what you're also seeing is because there was so much experience in the Great Recession/Depression that we just went through, banks learned how to do a lot of it in-house. So from a counsel perspective, you see less workouts make it out of the bank. You'll do for, you know, forbearance agreements. I'm starting to see those again, which I hadn't seen in a while. But straight up hardcore workouts are really kind of rare in this market, because also the banks on the deals that they have done have insisted on far better underwriting. And although there's a lot of banks, you know, out there dangling money, it's actually really hard for a borrower to get through to the end and get the actual credit facility in place. You know, and so that's kind of where we are today, and such that you don't see a lot of alternative purchasers for notes, for example, because their portfolios are kind of few and far between. My client who's in that business just first time in 18 months was able to close on the sale of a portfolio of notes, because he's been out hustling to get them. There haven't been enough to put together and package until now. So it's definitely a tighter credit market. It's a better run credit market, and you're seeing less opportunities right now. I think it'll change in a year to 18 months, in my opinion, just by, again, starting to see some cracks, such as forbearance agreements that we haven't been seeing. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think when it does turn, you know, eventually go to the downturn, I think you'll see faster, better workouts, because I think everyone learned how to do better deals with better borrowers and with better documentation.
So in other words, be a Boy Scout. Be prepared. That's what you're suggesting.
Be prepared.
Right. Well, operator, do we have any questions from our listeners?
There are no questions at this time.
Well, then, thank you, everyone. We're out of time. If you are not able to ask your question or one occurs to you in the future, you have our contact information, and we welcome your questions whenever you want to ask them. This is Dick Goldberg, and on behalf of Tony Licata, Mark Belongia, and myself, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you,
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's teleseminar.